Thank you, Bob. Yes, in spite of what Bob has said about me, he still remains my senior colleague in ministry, and I have so much respect for him. What's the time now? Good morning to you all. First of all, to say, I'm sorry I came in late. In fact, exactly an hour after the program has started, I thought I had sufficient time before I left home to be able to come on the bus. I should have actually come on the tube. So, you know, that got me delayed somewhere, and I had to take a cab from St. Pancras to this place. But I really wanted to be. I'm sorry. Thank you, please. Yes, I've seen where my name appears. There's just a bit about me. And can I just say, it said there that I'm from Ghana. Yes, I'm from Ghana. And I was talking to my sister, and I said I recently returned from Ghana about 2 weeks ago. I was there for a whole month and a half, trying to do some work in preparation for retirement for both my wife and myself. I know the children perhaps may choose to live here in the UK. That's their choice. Anyway, yes, my interest in Islam dates back to the early 90s when I was looking for a third A-level subject. And I was told that, you know, I could just choose Islam. I hadn't done it before because I did A-level, you know, government for A-level and business management, and I needed a third subject. So a friend advised me to take Islam. And since I wrote Islam at A-level, advanced level, I've not stopped trying to know more and to study more about Islam, which is what actually brought me into this country in 2001, where I did a master's degree, and 2 years ago I finished my PhD. So it's good to be able to speak to you on Islam, but it's not true that I know lots of things about Islam. I just know a bit about Islam. Good. The topic, as we all know, is handling biblical violence. And the question is then asked, whether the God of the Old Testament is nasty, brutish, and capricious. I think we must all acknowledge that since the events of September 11, 2001, the concept of, you know, violence known in Islam as the jihad has become so topical, debatable, and also contentious. And there is no agreement, as far as I know, regarding exactly whether the Quran does support the jihad. It's interesting that even among Muslims, of course, we know the majority of Muslims from the Sunni side. The Sunni side is said to be the mainstream grouping in Islam. They number about 90% of the global population of Muslims. But there is a smaller sect called the Ahmadiyya, which is a reformist movement within Islam. You know, rather than support the jihad and read the texts in the Quran that have information about the jihad, they tend to look at it in a different way. And, you know, they subscribe to what I would say, I'm sure my brother, who did the first presentation must have mentioned, that they are pacifists, the Ahmadiyya movement. As a result of what I've said, the events of the barbaric events of September 11, 2001, debate has been intense within Islam as to whether the Quran does contain verses and passages that sanction the jihad, understood here as military action against non-Muslims and aims to result in the conversion of such people. Similarly, outside of Islam, non-Muslim scholars, I'll be mentioning a few in my presentation, have also questioned whether a loving God can authorize the massacre of children, women, and men, as it is reported in some sources in Islam. The purpose of this paper, therefore, in the light of the points I've raised, is to examine some of the key verses and passages on the subject in the Quran and to show whether or not they support jihad theory. To do this, the paper is concerned to do three things. First of all, to examine the jihad from the perspective of the key theological and quasi-theological sources in Islam in order to find out what they really teach on the subject. And let me just explain the distinction between what I've said, key theological and quasi-theological sources. There are as many as four or five main sources within Islam, such that if you were investigating a doctrine or a belief in Islam, you would necessarily need to look at those sources. The most important of these being the Quran, which is said to be the verbal word of God transmitted to mankind through the agency of Muhammad from the years 610 AD to 632 AD. But besides the Quran, there are other sources that are important. These are the traditions of the Prophet, called the Hadith in Islam. The tafsir is meant to be to provide some guidelines as to how the 114 surahs or chapters in the Quran should be interpreted in such a way that Muslims, unlike Christians, will not differ on the meanings of verses and passages in the Quran. So that is called the tafsir or the exegetical tradition within Islam. And it dates back to pre-modern times where a number of scholars within Islam, some of whom have actually looked at my PhD work, they look at a number of doctrines, say for instance, Christology, because I did for my PhD, I was comparing contemporary writers against Christianity or Christian doctrines in Ghana in the light of some key pre-modern texts that were written by very prominent Islamic scholars from the 8th century onwards until the 14th century. Secondly, this paper will compare the themes of violence in the Old Testament and the Quran and to show what the similarities and dissimilarities are. Finally, this paper will seek to answer the question whether the God of the Old Testament can be characterized as nasty, brutish, and capricious in the light of the outcome of our investigation of the jihad in the Quran. The paper is therefore structured around these three key aims. So we begin to look at the jihad in the key theological sources. Generally, as I've said already, a thorough investigation of every doctrine in Islam is done via the Quran, the traditions, also called the Hadith, and the exegetical tradition called the Tafsir. In some cases, however, the Islamic sources that are examined are determined by the subject that is being investigated. In such cases, therefore, three additional key sources may be examined alongside the Quran, the traditions, and the exegetical tradition. These additional sources are the life of the Prophet Muhammad, called the Al-Sira, or the Book of Campaigns or Battles, called the Kitab al-Maghazi, and the earliest Muslim anti-Christian polemical literature. I have interest in the last, category of Muslim literature that I've referred to, i.e. the Muslim anti-Christian polemical literature, because as I've said, this was what I did for 6 years, part-time studies for a PhD degree, which I finished last year. For example, let me illustrate what I've said, that although three main sources within Islam are investigated, if we seek to understand any doctrine in Islam, depend upon what subject is being investigated, you may need to add a few more. For example, one cannot fully understand Islamic Christology without examining the earliest Muslim anti-Christian polemical literature, which includes the works of prominent pre-modern scholars like the 14th century CE Syrian Hanbali scholar Ibn Taymiyyah, who died in 1328 CE. Abu al-Jabbar, who also died in 1025 CE, and the Islamic scholar who was critical of his own religious tradition, Abu Isa al-Warraq, who died in the 9th century CE. The Muslim anti-Christian polemical works written by these scholars are among the most brilliant theological treatises on key traditional Christian doctrines ever produced. These works also contain a lot more information on Christology and the associated doctrines, such as the Trinity, Incarnation, the Crucifixion, etc., than is found in the Quran itself. In view of the points I have made above regarding the need for additional sources to be examined in studying some doctrines in Islam, such as Christology, this paper shall examine the life of the Prophet Muhammad, which is the Seerah, and the book of Campaigns or Battles, the Kitab al-Maghazi, in addition to the three traditional sources we noted earlier in this paper. Some observations about jihad theory are worth noting at this point before we proceed with a detailed analysis of the subject from the perspective of the sources we have noted above. Firstly, the teaching of the Quran on the subject is far from consistent because the meaning of the word itself is fluid. I have some books carrying my bag, and there's no time to refer to them and read some verses, but I'll soon come to some of them. Sometimes it is assumed that if, you know, there's a discussion about the jihad, it should be understood as if the whole of the Quran does support the jihad, or, you know, every occurrence of the word jihad in the Quran means an armed or military action against non-Muslims. What this implies is that the word may have one meaning in one chapter of the Quran and a completely different meaning in another chapter, and we'll be looking at that shortly. This point will be illustrated when we examine the relevant texts and passages in the Quran on the subject. In other words, whereas the word jihad appears in numerous passages and texts in the Quran, it does not have a single meaning throughout the Quran. Rather, the meaning of jihad in any given passage is either understood independently or in conjunction with passages in other chapters. And that, you know, I really need to shed more light on this. You see, the Quran is, I'll, there's a bit to say about it later. But let me just say it at this point, that, you know, the present arrangement of the Quran, comprising in all 114 chapters, that arrangement is not done chronologically. In other words, the arrangement, as we have it in the Quran, doesn't reflect the manner in which the revelations were said to have been revealed to Muhammad. Rather, we find that there are longer chapters in the present arrangement, and there are shorter chapters, and that has nothing whatsoever to do with the order in which the chapters of the Quran were revealed. I will come to that a little later. Secondly, the jihad has historically been interpreted in two ways. There is a juristic interpretation, or it is interpreted juristically and non-juristically. In my dissertation entitled A Comparative Analysis of the Islamic Jihad and the Just War Traditions, which was presented for an MA degree in Religious Studies at the University of Lancaster in 2002, I pointed out that the jihad came to denote an armed struggle against non-Muslims from the second century after the Hijrah. The Hijrah here is when Muhammad and a few of his followers, left left Mecca because they were fleeing from persecution by the pagans and the residents of Mecca in 622. And it's interesting that the Islamic calendar begins from this year, 622 CE or AD. I'm used to AD, but people keep saying, you know, when in academic circles you need to use CE instead of AD. So I'm trying to work myself into that. So I pointed out in this dissertation that there are two, the armed struggle interpretation of the jihad became popular in the second century after the Hijrah, which I said I was trying to explain what the Hijrah means when Muhammad and some of his followers left Mecca and, you know, fled to Medina as they were seeking protection from the persecution they suffered in Mecca. It is instructive to note that this juristic meaning of the word has gained wide currency to the present day. In many cases, when the word jihad is mentioned, most people quickly think about it in terms of an armed struggle. And I'm saying this has become the case because the legal schools in the 8th century, you know, the Islamic legal schools, they actually popularized this view or interpretation or understanding of the jihad as an armed struggle. Despite the fact, as we shall see below, that this meaning does not lack support in the Quran, it forecloses and attempts to consider and does not attempt to consider other shades of meaning of the word. There is also a non-juristic meaning of the jihad, which according to Al-Ghanami is derived from the Arabic word jahada or juhud and denotes ability, exertion, and power, etc. Thirdly, given the present arrangement of the Quran in the sense that the chapters, passages, and individual verses are not arranged chronologically, a point I've already mentioned, but this is exactly where in my presentation it appears. It is difficult to interpret the meaning of jihad or its derivatives whenever they occur in the Quran. What I mean is, because of the fact that the Quran, we all understand the importance of context in reading any book, any piece of literature, including the Bible, don't we? And because it's not possible to reconstruct the historical context of the revelations of the Quran, let me go back there. Thirdly, given the present arrangement of the Quran in the sense that the chapters and passages, as well as individual verses, are not arranged chronologically, it is difficult to interpret the meaning of jihad whenever it occurs in the Quran. To be able to interpret the verses correctly would therefore require a reconstruction of their original context within which they were first revealed, which are referred to by scholars as the occasions of revelation. Very interesting here. We have in the Quran, you know, as we have it today, verses that seem to be contradictory. Islamic scholars have therefore found, I would say, an exegetical technique or tool to get around that. What is this exegetical tool? To be able to get around verses in the Quran that seem to contradict each other is to say, two ways, they've done this in two ways, is to say that, is to look for, you know, particular circumstances in the life of the early Muslim community in Medina or in Mecca or in the life of Muhammad himself when these revelations were given. It's interesting in chapter 33 of the Quran, there's an I think verse 40, there's an interesting thing there. The Prophet Muhammad had his secretary, Abu Zaid. We are not told, the Quran doesn't always give us the, you know, the context. But you read in other sources in Islam, perhaps the Seerah, the life of the Prophet, where, you know, there were problems between Ibn Zayd's wife and himself. But as I've told you, Ibn Zayd was a secretary to the Prophet. What then happened is that the Prophet, instead of trying to bring the two together, turned around and took Ibn Zayd's wife, married Ibn Zayd's wife. That's just an example of how, you know, scholars are trying to find out exactly what the occasions of the revelations of certain parts of the Quran are to be able to understand them. And it's interesting, you know, a revelation that comes from God to say, oh, from now on, it is permissible for you to marry the wife of someone who is close to you. Whether this revelation came to what's the word? to absolve, I mean, to say that the Prophet hadn't done any wrong thing, we don't know. But this is just an example of how many of the revelations in the Quran are to be understood within the context in which they were revealed. As this is an American scholar, I think, Reuven has pointed out, the occasions of revelation are useful in enabling Muslims to determine the historical context within which a particular revelation was given. Clearly, the occasions of revelation, as we have mentioned above, seem to me to be an exegetical tool that was used and continues to be used by Islamic scholars and exegetes to understand to what occasions either the life of Muhammad or the early Muslim community in Medina that a particular revelation was given to Muhammad. Sadly, however, despite the effort to reconstruct the original context of the revelations, scholars and exegetes have not been successful in doing so. These are just observations and they seek to shed more light on what I'll be saying later. Fourthly, yet another observation regarding what we're doing. Fourthly, owing to the difficulty in constructing the original historical context of the life of Muhammad and the early Islamic community within which the revelations of the Quran were given, scholars have used yet another exegetical tool to reconcile seemingly contradictory verses and passages. The classic case of this is the meanings of Quran chapter 15, verse 94 to 95, and Quran chapter 2, verse 216. In fact, I've said here, there's a difficulty in reconciling what these two verses teach about the subject of war. In the former, meaning the, you know, Quran 15, 94 to 95, the proclamation of Islam is to be done in a non-confrontational way. In the latter, however, Muhammad and the Muslim believers are permitted to fight their enemies. The exegetical tool that is used to reconcile such texts and passages is that, you know, is to say that the latest revelation has abrogated the earliest. Say, for instance, in terms of time, that something came first. That which comes afterwards must, of course, take precedence over what was first revealed. So the doctrine or the exegetical tool where, verses actually abrogate one another. Finally, yes, pardon me. Finally, the texts and passages about violence in the Quran are to be found in the Medinan surahs or revelations rather than the Meccan. Can I just explain? I'm sure some of you know this. We have 114 chapters that make the Quran. And scholars have gone into these chapters and divided them up into two types of revelations. One, you know, some surahs or some revelations are said to be Meccan, others are said to be Medina. Remember that Muhammad was called, according to Islamic history, to preach Islam in Mecca. But after 10 or so years, when there was no success at all in Mecca, he had to go to Medina. And so this distinction between Meccan surahs or revelations and Medina surahs, you know, it's not made on the basis of where a particular revelation was revealed, but rather whether a particular revelation was revealed before 622 AD or after 622 AD. Because remember, I said this earlier, that 622 AD marks the beginning of Islamic history. Although, you know, the Prophet had been preaching 10 years earlier. By and large, the Meccan revelations largely focus on the key doctrines of God, such as the oneness of God to all heed in Islam, the belief in earlier prophets, the belief in revealed books, the Psalms, the Zabur, that is what is called in Islam, the Zabur of David, Dawood, the Torah of, you know, Moses, and the Injil of Jesus Christ. And you can see me laughing. It's interesting because, you know, when the Quran and in Islam, when they mention the Injil, they actually don't mean the four Gospels we have, but they actually mean that there was an original message that was given to Muhammad, to Jesus, which is now lost. And it's interesting how they look at things this way. Okay, perhaps at question time, you may want some clarifications on this. These Meccan revelations also warn sinners about the day of judgment should they fail to heed the preaching of the message of Islam. By and large, the Meccan revelations are generally devoid of violence against non-Muslims. The point I'm making here is that most of the verses in the Quran that relate to information about the jihad are the verses, the revelations that were revealed after 622, not before. Quite the contrary, the Meccan revelations appear to be those in which Muhammad and the Muslim community are given permission to wage war against non-Muslims. Marshall, this is an English scholar, Islamicist, David Marshall, he has noted that the threats of punishment on non-Muslims and pagans in the Meccan revelations are fulfilled, but in a transformed form, namely in the form of an armed military or campaigns against non-Muslims after Hijrah. What I'm saying here is that if you read the Meccan surahs, those revelations in the Quran that were revealed before 622, the hearers of the message of Islam were always threatened with punishment and told that if they refused to heed the warning of the Prophet or the message the Prophet was bringing or was preaching, they were going to be punished. Marshall now says that was actually delayed. The punishment was delayed until after 622, and the punishment then came in the form of the jihad. Very interesting point is made. And if you were to read the Quran and read it closely and read other, theological sources in Islam, that would seem to suggest, it would seem to suggest that he is right. He's made a very good point. The view expressed by Marshall above is further corroborated by Riven when he observes that in the last 9 years of Muhammad's life in Medina, he participated in 27 battles and also deputized 59 campaigns against non-Muslims. I just hope at question time I can make this clearer. Now, we haven't mentioned and noted these observations that will shed light on what we'll be looking at in the Quran regarding jihad. We now turn to the Quran itself. Overall, the teaching of the Quran regarding jihad can be grouped under four main headings. Firstly, however, we begin with the meaning of the word jihad. In his book, Jihad, The Origins of Holy War in Islam, Riven Firestone notes that the semantic meaning of jihad neither connotes holy war nor war in general. Further, he argues that jihad is derived from the root jahad, which means, among other things, to strive or exert oneself or take extraordinary pains. The non-military argument in relation to the meaning of jihad we noted above is corroborated by Bonner. Bonner is also an American scholar, I think, who argues that when the word is used in the Quran, it does not refer to warfare, but to any effort made for the sake of God and in his cause. David Cook, I think, is another American scholar, appears to be in agreement with these two scholars when he argues that the literal meaning of the word jihad is striving or exerting oneself. Clearly, these three scholars appear to be critical of the view that the word does not, they are critical of the view that the word jihad connotes or denotes military combat. And I agree that when the word is used in the Quran, it does not always connote a military action against non-Muslims. Secondly, we will now focus on the texts and passages in the Quran. We were just looking at the etymology of the word jihad. Secondly, we focus on what the Quran teaches about the subject. Four strands of teaching on the subject are to be identified in the Quran. We shall discuss each of these strands and also cite the relevant texts that support them. It is instructive to note that the four strands of teaching that will be discussed below are part of the classical evolutionary theory of war used throughout Muslim scholarship of the Quran to make sense of the different texts and passages about war in the Quran. Let me explain this. I said classical evolutionary theory of war in the Quran. You don't find those words in the Quran, but if you read the Quran closely, you find that there are parts of the Quran where I've actually cited two examples already, or three, you know, where the Quran says, commands Muhammad to use wisdom in propagating Islam and no violence. Then there are other passages that tell the Muslims, if your enemies attack you, attack them in self-defense. There are other passages in the Quran, we'll be looking at, we haven't come to that yet, but I'm only explaining what the evolutionary, the classical evolutionary theory of war in the Quran is. Then there's the third strand is that Muslims were free, they were permitted to attack their enemies if they wished to do so. And then finally, the final strand is that Muslims were given permission, unconditional, you know, permission under no circumstances, whether they were attacked or not, they were free to look for the unbelievers, slay them, and kill them until they submitted to Islam. We'll find this in the Quran. I'll read some of the texts. Having said this, we can now look at these strands one after the other. Firstly, the Quran appears from our reading of some verses to legislate a non-confrontational attitude in relation to how Muhammad should relate to non-Muslims in the preaching of Islam. In other words, Muhammad was not permitted to use any military force in preaching Islam. Rather, he was commanded to openly spread the message as seen in the two passages we shall be looking at below. One, and this is from Quran chapter 15, verse 94 to 95, and it reads, profess openly what you have been commanded, and turn away from the idolaters, for we are sufficient for you against the scoffers. Then two, invite all to the way of your Lord with wisdom and beautiful preaching, and argue with them in ways that are best and most gracious. For your Lord knows best who has strayed from his path and who receives guidance. Quran chapter 16, verse 125. Look at that. These two are taught by scholars, and when you read them closely, you will agree that they are non-confrontational. Secondly, there are some verses in the Quran that seem to suggest that permission was given to the Muslims to fight, to defend themselves against their enemies. In other words, some verses, such as the two below, seem to suggest that the Muslim believers could fight in self-defense. Quran 22, verse 39 to 40a. Permission is given to those who fight because they have been wronged. God is most powerful for their aid. Those who have been unjustly expelled from their homes only because they say, "Our Lord is God." The second, in each of these cases, I've just picked two verses of the Quran. The second example of these verses that permitted Muslims to fight in self-defense is this. Quran chapter 2, verse 190. "Fight in the path of God those who fight you, but do not transgress limits, for God does not love transgressors." It has been suggested that the above verse, which is the second verse I've just read, was revealed after Muhammad and the small band of Muslims left Mecca for Medina to escape the persecution of the Meccan polytheists. What's happening here is that just as Muhammad and some of his followers left Mecca on their way to Medina, one of his companions, those who were very close to him, told him, "What if on our way we are attacked by our enemies?" Then the revelation came to the Prophet Muhammad, "If you are attacked by your enemies, you are free to fight back, to fight in self-defense." And it's interesting, you find I've made that at the end of this, made that observation at the end of this paper. I've said, it's difficult to tell whether, it's not because I'm a Christian, but you're just looking at the evidence. It's difficult to tell when God is speaking in the Quran and when Muhammad is saying something. It's difficult to tell. Because the revelation of the Quran seems to be intertwined with certain things happening in the life of Muhammad. So that it's difficult to tell who is actually speaking. According to Riven, this revelation, Quran chapter 2, verse 190, was the first verse of its kind that was revealed, granting permission to the Muslims to fight their enemies. Thirdly, some verses in the Quran appear to give permission to the Muslim believers to initiate a military attack against their enemies, provided they observe the ancient strictures. Interestingly, in pre-Islamic Arabia, you know, Arabia as it was before the birth of Islam, there were certain, because, you know, there were different clans and tribes living in Arabia. So they agreed on certain things as to keep the peace. And so although warfare was common, they agreed that there were certain months that fighting wasn't going to be done. So you could not fight during certain months. And there were certain places, like the sanctuary in Mecca called the Kaaba. You couldn't fight around the Kaaba. These were the strictures. And so here the verse is saying, you can fight your enemies, but only when you remember to observe the ancient strictures. That before Islam, the people of Arabia had agreed to keep certain things in order to keep the peace. It has been suggested that the ancient strictures were rules that governed how warfare was conducted in Arabia before the advent of Islam. Some of these stipulated that war could not be fought during certain months and also not within the vicinity of the ancient sanctuary in Mecca. This is evident in the two passages below. I'm looking at two passages here again. "They will ask you about fighting in the sacred months. You will be companions of fire and remain there forever." The verse is saying, I've not quoted it in its totality because it's so long, so I've just cut it, you know. The verse seems to be saying that, you know, the non-Muslims will be asking the Muslim believers why they are not fighting. And it says that, you know, they will not fight because they were observing the rules, the ancient rules about war before Islam was born. Again, there's another verse. "Kill them wherever you find them, for fitna, idolatry, is worse than killing. But do not fight them at the sacred mosque. But if they fight you, kill them. Quran chapter 2 verse 191. Finally, remember I said that, you know, in all you can identify four strands in terms of how the jihad should be understood whenever it is used in the Quran. Finally, the jihad was prescribed for the Muslim community as an unconditional command to fight. Historically, this group of Muslims for whom jihad was prescribed refers to the earliest Muslim community in Medina. The group consisted of the immigrants who fled to Medina with the Prophet Muhammad in 622 CE, and the helpers or Ansar. Ansar is an Arabic word meaning helpers. They were, you know, Muhammad may have, or people from Medina may have come to Mecca, heard the preaching of Muhammad, and because of the persecution that Muhammad and the small band of his followers were facing in Mecca, arrangements were made for the Prophet to leave Mecca and go to Medina, because there were people over there who were prepared and willing to protect him. So these are the helpers or the answer of the Muslim immigrants who were inhabitants of Medina but converted to Islam. The command to fight is inescapable in the following words in Quran 2:216 below. Fighting is commanded on you, but if you dislike something which is good, God knows, but you know not. What is happening here is that there were some of the early Muslims who didn't enjoy fighting. And so this verse is saying, you may not, you know, where others are in the battlefield and they're fighting against non-Muslims, you are at home because you don't like fighting, you don't enjoy fighting. But you don't know. This is something that God has commanded for you, which is good for you. So even within the Islamic community at the time, there were some people who were against, the jihad being waged against non-Muslims. The second, when the sacred months are over, kill the idolaters. Wherever you find them, God is forgiving and merciful. Quran 9:5. The traditions, I said in my introduction that to do a thorough investigation of the jihad or jihad, one really needs to look beyond the Quran. Although, in the final analysis, the information that we will find in the traditions in terms of what they say about jihad are no different from what we have already looked at, because the Quran is the most important theological source for Islam, and other sources derive their information on any given subject from the Quran. I mean, other sources in Islam use the Quran as their source material. It is instructive, I'm not looking at it under the traditions, looking at the jihad under the traditions. It is instructive to mention that the traditions constitute the second most important source for studying Islamic doctrine and practice in Islam after the Quran itself. We should also know that the information about jihad in the traditions derive from the Quran. Usually, there are sections in the major collections of the traditions about the jihad, and where that is not the case, there are sections that contain information about the jihad nonetheless. What I'm saying is, there are some, when we say the traditions, there can be confusion about what the traditions are. If you were to use the word traditions, you are referring to something broader than the prophetic traditions. But if you were to use the word prophetic to qualify traditions, you're actually saying you're interested in sayings and acts of Muhammad. But if you're talking about the traditions in general, you're talking both about things that Muhammad said and did, and things that those who succeeded him said and did, and things that other Muslim scholars said, they all come under the tradition. So it's always good to draw a distinction between the prophetic tradition and the traditions as a whole. We now inquire into what the traditions teach about the jihad. And I'm going to, I'm saying just two things, because the information here is exactly what we have looked at in the Quran. The information that is in the traditions is similar to that which we have just considered in the Quran above. However, we shall say two things about the jihad from the perspective of the tradition. Firstly, the traditions teach that jihad was permanently established till the day of judgment. And you recall, when I looked at the last strand of the teaching about, you know, jihad in the Quran, I quoted a text in the Quran which says that, you know, jihad has been commanded for you as Muslims. The traditions are actually saying, for all time, Muslims have an obligation to fight non-Muslims. Secondly, the Prophet valued the jihad so much so that he said that it was comparable to fasting during the time of, you know, when the Muslims fast. He's saying that those who fight the jihad have the same reward as those who fast during the months of Ramadan. The seerah is what I mentioned, and there's a little to say about that. The seerah literature contains, as we noted above, information about the battles in which Muhammad fought in the last 9 years of his life. This is why a large portion of the seerah is dedicated to the battles in which the Prophet fought, thus making it necessary for the Maghazi literature to be written. I've already referred to this. Now we come to the Kitab al-Maghazi. Some scholars have characterized the last 10 years of Muhammad, which I've just mentioned, after he fled to Medina in 622, as the years of military campaigns and battles. The justification for this characterization is that these years were spent by Muhammad both leading and commissioning military campaigns against non-Muslims, whether pagans, Jews, or Christians. We have already pointed out, we have already made the observation that the people that Muhammad fought in 27 battles during the last 9 years of his life. This then shows that when you're looking at the Kitab al-Maghazi, which is a kind of literature in Islam that actually records the battles in which Muhammad fought and whether the Muslim community won or lost, you know, you find that the Kitab al-Maghazi does put weight on the jihad, because even the Prophet himself, as I've just said, is said to have fought in 27 of such battles. Closing remarks. We should make three key observations as we seek to answer the question whether the God of the Old Testament is nasty, brutish, and capricious. As I was looking at this, I really didn't know what to do with it, because when you're looking at the Old Testament, I wish I was here to hear what my friend said. You know, I would have picked a few things from there. You know, but when you're looking at the Old Testament, in the light of what the Quran teaches about jihad, there are, on the one hand, some similarities, but vast differences as well. One of the most important, or the key similarity, is whether in the Quran or the Bible, we can characterize these wars, whether they be found in Joshua or in Deuteronomy or in Judges, as religious wars that were sanctioned by God. And it's the same in the Quran. Yet, in the Quran, there are differences. Differences in the sense that it seems to me that when you look at these verses closely in the Quran, some of which we've looked at, it seems to me that jihad was fought for certain reasons. First of all, but again, there's a similarity there, you know, because the early Muslims sought to occupy and to gain more territory. I know the we are told, Islam entered Africa via North Africa. And in one of said battles, in fact, the first battle, an army of Muslim soldiers left Arabia and made their way to North Africa and fought the Berbers and forced them to submit to Islam. But it's interesting here because something about Christianity at the time should be mentioned. Someone has actually said, a scholar has said, it's not as if the North Africans could not resist the military campaigns of the Muslims, but just because they were fed up with the Church of the Empire at the time. Because you now have to think about at the time from the 4th century, 325, the Council of Nicaea, and the council that followed, because of the doctrinal disputes, there were some smaller groups within, the church at the time that sought to free themselves from the control of the bigger church. And so when the Muslims came to North Africa, fighting, all the Christians did was just to surrender because they were looking for a savior. Because their own, Christians wouldn't accept them. They saw them as minority groups because they were either Coptics or they believed in the one nature of Jesus, or whether they were Nestorians or they were, help me with my church history here. I need to think before I pick these things up. But that's what's happening. What I'm saying here is that clearly in the jihad, in the prosecution of the jihad, one finds that, Muhammad and his little band of followers, whether in Mecca or in Medina, but especially in Medina, they were looking to expand, their territory. And we find, there's evidence for this, because we're told that when Muhammad fled to Mecca, he added to his role as a prophet another role as a statesman. And so immediately, the tribes, Jewish tribes and Christians who were in Medina were brought together for them to write what? To put together a document that sought to regulate the life of those who lived in Medina. In actual fact, the point I'm making is that although there are differences, although there's a great similarity in the sense that the wars of the Old Testament were religious wars in the sense that they were authorized by God, there are differences because it seems to me that in the case of the jihad, the Muslim community were finding ways of expanding their territory and making sure that Islam became the religion of their part of the world. Thirdly, we noted in the Maghazi literature in the Sira that Muhammad personally fought in 27 battles. We therefore conclude on the basis of the analysis of the concept of jihad in the Quran that it paints a picture of God as one who will authorize the extermination of innocent children, women and men. What remains to be said, however, is whether these verses, from the point of view of Islam, were the direct commands of Allah in the Quran, given the fact that like parts of the Quran reflect important circumstances in the life of Muhammad and the early Muslim community in Medina. The last part is what I haven't really done justice to, but I'll end here, please. Thank you.